Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
But you also had people that were very fine people.
Very fine people.
On both sides.
And the aliens would mind meld and give them the technology. They're bad aliens. So are you surprised the Nazis were influenced by demons?
No, if demons are real, I would definitely think they'd be on the side of the Nazis.
Yeah.
McDonald's is connected to the Clintons. They chop up the bodies and put them into the sausage and hamburgers. People are being cannibalized. Look it up.
And I'm watching CNN talk about this as violent white nationalist protests. We have done everything in our power to keep this peaceful, you know?
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
Welcome to Yeah Na Passaran, a show about fascism and its gravediggers. I'm Cam Smith.
I'm Andy Fleming.
And this week we are joined by Elise Thomas, who is a senior OSINT analyst at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. Thanks for joining us, Elise.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, it's been quite a year, Elise. One of your beats is misinformation and disinformation, and you've been kept quite busy. How has 2024 been in terms of people telling lies on the internet?
You'll be surprised to know they're still doing it. We haven't fixed the problem, unfortunately. Yeah, it's definitely been an interesting year. Before I start, I should just say that everything that I say here, I'm representing my own views and not representing the views of ISD. But yeah, like it's been a very interesting year on a variety of fronts.
We had the US election where we saw huge injections of cash from the likes of Elon Musk. It seemed that the bots were running wild on X.com, the everything app. Looking at the election that we just had in the US, how did you feel to compare it in terms of misinformation and disinformation as compared to previous elections?
I mean, it's a previous US elections, you mean, or sort of previous elections in other locations?
Yeah, well, maybe previous elections in the US, but also, yeah, how did it compare to what we've been seeing globally?
I mean, it's sort of difficult to like, it's kind of like apples to oranges, I guess. Different jurisdictions are quite different in a variety of ways. I guess what we saw in the US election, I guess it got kind of some of the notable trends that we've kind of seen over the course of the year. I think at the start of the year, there was a lot of concern about the potential impact of AI in electoral processes on disinformation. And we haven't really seen the worst fears come to fruition in that sense. Like, I don't think we saw anywhere, sort of, for example, an election potentially impacted by a really convincing deep fake or some of the other nightmare scenarios that we were discussing at the start of the year. I think what we have seen is, in terms of the impact for like AI and elections specifically, we've seen like just a huge explosion of chum, just like AI chum everywhere. So I think what we're seeing at the moment with AI and disinformation is that it's expanding the abilities of mostly low-level commercial actors to produce content at scale, including like highly clickable content like political content focused on elections. And I think we saw that a lot in the context of the US election just past. There were a lot of commercial actors who were very active on both sides creating, I don't know if you'd even call it disinformation, just like highly emotionally charged political content. So just kind of turning up the temperature on that political debate for their own purposes in order to make money. So we've seen quite a lot of that. Obviously, some of the changes that we've seen in terms of the platforms and the regulation on the platforms is quite different from the context of 2020. So in 2020, the 2020 US presidential elections, most of the platforms were fairly active in terms of trying to moderate, be on the front foot around moderating electoral disinformation. Obviously, like that was coming off the back of 2016, where they faced so much criticism for not moderating. In 2024, I think we've seen a noticeable step back, obviously, most prominently from the platform formerly known as Twitter and now known as X, but also from some of the other platforms. Meta, for example, has been like much less proactive in terms of fact-checking or removing electoral disinformation or misleading content. So, yeah, there's been kind of a variety of changes. I think in some ways the most significant systemic change has been what's happened to X. But yeah, there's kind of a bunch of factors at play.
At least there was a perception in some of those past elections that, you know, there were bots wreaking havoc online. And it seems now that we're living in the world of ChatGPT, we can sort of see the bots at work, that probably those bots were just a whole bunch of people sitting in a building having to work. How has it changed that there does seem to be this vast sea of fake people commenting on things and sometimes just commenting quite innocuously but in disagreement with people?
Yeah, I mean, so far it's actually not changing, as far as we can tell, not changing very much. So we have seen these commercial actors who are sort of like spoofing political content for engagement, and also state-linked actors. We have seen some experimentation with the use of like large language models for producing content, so the big bot networks. So far we're actually not seeing that it's significantly more effective than anything they were doing before. So it doesn't actually seem, from anything that I've seen anyway, that those operations are successful in driving more engagement. So the significant difference, I think, is like cost and scale. So if you are a commercial actor, and by commercial actor I mean, for example, someone sitting in their bedroom in Vietnam or Thailand and you're running one of these networks to make money, it's now much cheaper and easier for you to do that. So like that's a significant difference, because it means you're going to have a lot more of those networks. And particularly when you combine that with, as I said, like some of the changes we've seen, particularly on X, which have made it a much more bot-friendly space. So the combination of those two things, also sort of the changes around direct payment to blue tick creators, again, that's created a way to monetize specifically on that platform, incentivizing, you know, the teenager sitting in their bedroom somewhere in Southeast Asia or Africa or Eastern Europe, which tend to be sort of the geographic centers of these industries for sort of reasons related to like kind of like cost of living and sort of how much money you can make per click per ad. It creates the incentive for them to set up a network like this and make actually some pretty decent money running political content. Now they can do that quite, and previously like that would have been quite a painstaking and difficult process. They would have needed, you know, several people to just sit there all day kind of commenting away. Now they can automate it, set it, forget it, and just sort of have that almost a passive income stream coming in. So the scale of that industry has really grown in a way that I think will have consequences down the line. But for state actors, who the resources is much less of a concern for them, like they're totally capable of paying a large number of people to just sit in an office all day and kind of plug away at it, for them it doesn't seem to be a step change as yet. They're still like pushing out these networks and they're still getting essentially no engagement on a lot of this content. So yeah, so the implications so far are kind of like more on that commercial side at the moment rather than kind of state-linked propaganda.
Melissa, how decisive or important do you think X was in terms of the US election, and what do you expect its future to be? Do you expect it to continue to play this role as a form of propaganda for the Trump administration?
Oh, look, I've got no idea. I think there will be many, many PhDs in trying to figure out what role X may or may not have played in the outcome of the 2024 election. And I think I think the future of X also is super interesting. And I think anyone who says they know what's going to happen is fibbing. Yeah, I don't know. I think it'll depend a lot on like what the relationship between Musk and Trump is going forward. Also, like what is the relationship between Trump and Truth Social going forward? So if Trump wants to continue to keep most of his own personal social media activity on Truth Social, and if he wants to continue to drive traffic towards Truth Social, maybe that sort of makes him a little bit less favorable towards X. On the other hand, if we sort of see more of a merging of Truth Social and X, then obviously that's good news for Musk. So, yeah, I honestly don't know.
I'm sure whatever it is, it'll be very efficient.
Elise, over the past few months, we've seen a lot of proposals from the Australian government about cleaning up the internet, especially for young people. One of the things that they've done is introduce legislation which would require social media platforms to keep kids off them. You've seen what happens when people are kept off mainstream social media platforms. What's your take on how this teenage social media ban might play out?
I think they've created a real headache for whoever's job it is to implement it. You know, I think it's in some ways pretty striking that they passed this legislation without knowing how they were going to do it or who was going to do it or how it was going to be regulated and managed, or like even what is a way to do it in an effective in an effective manner. There's many other jurisdictions have tried to do this. The UK spent looking into how to do age verification for porn sites. They wanted to block porn sites to only over 18s. And they spent years looking into it. And the best they came up with was you've got to give the porn sites your driver's license or your credit card details or your phone billing data, which I think is not, to my mind, is not an acceptable or workable outcome, because it sort of comes with the trade-off of preventing young people from accessing these sites that we don't think they should have access to is a massive invasion of privacy and of data, and creating a data security risk for everybody else. Because obviously once you provide that data to whatever site you're trying to access, you're then relying on them to either delete it and properly delete it as well, not have it kind of like they think they've deleted it, but it actually is sort of sitting somewhere on their system where it could be accessed by hackers, because obviously that is very valuable personal data. Or in some cases, they might hold on to it and use it for marketing purposes, even if they're required to delete it. Like we've seen case after case of tech companies having data that they are legally required to delete and just sitting on it or using it for purposes that they were not supposed to be using it for. So, I mean, I think, and I understand that the government has now sort of put this out to a process to try and establish a method of doing this in Australia for under 16s. I doubt they're going to come back with any significantly different answers. And so I think we probably are, if they want to implement this rather than just kind of kick the can down the road for several years via more and more inquiries, which I feel like is probably also a viable option for them, if they want to implement this, then I think they have to be really upfront with the Australian public about the fact that this is not just something that affects under 16. This is something that will affect every single person who uses a social media platform, because we will all have to verify our age. And that means that we will all have to do something along the lines of either providing our personal data. I know they've ruled out that people are going to be required to provide their driver's licenses or whatever directly to the social media companies, but you might be required to provide it. I don't know if they'll suggest perhaps providing it to a government agency, which would then tell the social media companies that you are over 16. And obviously the consequence of that is now the government has a list of everybody's social media accounts, which I don't know about you, I don't love that idea, or sort of allowing them to scan your face, for example, so they've got your biometric data. And obviously the problem with that is that age verification via biometrics, particularly via facial scans, is very inaccurate. Like it can sort of tell, are you 19 or are you 90? But it can't tell the difference between are you 18 or are you 19 or are you 15 or are you 16, for example. So, yeah, I think they've created a bit of a rod for their own back, to be honest.
Well, at least we can say with some certainty that getting all the kids onto Telegram can only go well.
Yeah. And this is the other consequence. If it works, the kids are not going to get off the internet. They're going to find somewhere else to go, and they will go to less regulated, less controlled spaces, the most obvious of which is Telegram. And obviously we've seen in the past what happens when sort of whole cohorts of people get kicked off the mainstream platforms and go onto Telegram. And the first thing that happens really is that they get exposed to a lot of content that is banned on the mainstream social media platforms, a lot of really extreme sexual content, a lot of really graphic, violent content, a lot of extremist material. That's what we've seen communities like deliberately bombarded with, deliberately targeted with on Telegram in the context of other groups who've been removed from social media. And I think there is a strong possibility that is what would happen to the under 16s if they were to be effectively kicked off the mainstream social media platforms. Maybe not so much for the really young ones, the sort of the under 10s. I hope they wouldn't be on Telegram, who knows. But a 15-year-old, 13-year-old, absolutely.
At least in terms of insofar as disinformation or misinformation constitutes an industry, would I be right in thinking that the industry is growing despite these attempted forms of regulations?
Oh, absolutely, for sure. And there's it's an absolutely fascinating industry, and it kind of like works across multiple levels. So there's sort of there's sort of like a domestic misinformation, disinformation industry, people who kind of make money off that doing this sitting in Australia. But as I was saying before, there's also a global industry that tends to be based in like specific parts of the world where cost of living is quite low and where you have large populations of well-educated young people without access to good job opportunities. So there's a really big sort of focus of this industry, particularly in parts of Southeast Asia, Vietnam, China, Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, huge one, obviously the Philippines, and obviously, and we do also see hubs of it in Eastern Europe. There's sort of the famous Macedonian fake news farms, like that is based on something. They really do exist, but also kind of Romania, parts of Africa, these really big industries, which yet tend to be based in these parts of the developing world and tend to be targeted at the developed world because those are the countries that you can make the most money off. Like, for example, if you're running ads on your website, you get a certain amount of money per click on each ad or per view of each ad. And the amount of money that you get is often based on which country that person who's viewing the ad is in. So, for example, I think it's off the top of my head, I think actually the UAE is the most valuable per click or view. And behind that, it's the US. But sort of there's sort of this, like, basically this kind of like global industry based mostly in the developing world, targeting mostly the wealthy developed world with misinformation, disinformation, also cute cat videos, sports videos, cooking stuff. Like, it's all just like designed to get you to click on ads or view ads. So you sort of have this both this international misinfo, disinfo industry and also like a domestic, like local grifters and sort of the transnational elements too, sort of like the grifters based in the US, for example, who are also getting audiences here in Australia, Australian grifters getting audiences in the US. So yeah, it's a really complicated, fascinating industry. And the economics are changing quite significantly at the moment because of, as I was saying earlier, the accessibility of generative AI and sort of what that does, particularly to the bottom end of the market, the people who are just like pumping out content on an industrial scale. It's just gotten a lot cheaper for them to do that, which I think is going to have a lot of kind of consequences further down the line.
I think it's complicated too in that Andy was thinking, oh, this doesn't sound too good until you mentioned the cute cats. And then he's like, well, maybe it's not so bad.
This is the upside. There's a lot of free, like I love those Twitter accounts where it's like cute cats in strange situations. It's just like a cat with their head in a lampshade. Like, honestly, I get enjoyment out of that. So I don't mind some of those.
Well, cats are cool. That's not disinformation or misinformation. This is just the facts.
Yeah, that's true.
There has been some criticism of those who critique the industry as being concerned with regulating speech in a way that reflects other political interests. In your own work, how do you go about distinguishing between what can be said to properly constitute disinformation and misinformation, and what constitutes the kinds of general disagreements about fact and perspective that otherwise constitute political discourse? And also, I guess, conjoined to that is that the kind of fear of some form of regulation that restricts people's access to information in general.
Yeah, I mean, this is a conversation that we have all the time because it is a really complicated and a really difficult issue. I think as a kind of as a basic rule of thumb, or sort of like the ground rules, is that we go by the law. So if a particular jurisdiction, for example, like in Germany, there are sort of some fairly strict rules around what you can and can't say. So like the law is kind of the basic thing that we work off. And then beyond that, the questions of kind of the good thing about kind of being in the research space is like we're not actually at the pointy end of these decisions. So we can come out and say like, this is bad, but we're not necessarily saying that it should be blocked or taken down or deleted, for example. And there's a whole spectrum between sort of this, like there's a whole spectrum in terms of responses from like take down versus leave up. You can sort of say this content should be allowed on the platform, but perhaps it shouldn't be allowed to go viral, or it shouldn't be sort of algorithmically boosted. So there's a whole kind of spectrum of potential responses. In terms of like how I personally think about what constitutes disinformation versus misinformation, if it is factually untrue, if it is on the facts untrue, then I'm reasonably comfortable calling it disinformation or misinformation most of the time. Like, obviously this is always sort of like it's a kind of a case by case basis, but if it's factually untrue most of the time, I'm confident to call it mis or disinfo. As a sidebar, I actually kind of I'm not a big fan of the terminology around misinformation and disinformation. It's kind of what we're stuck with because it's what everybody uses. But I think it sort of requires you to kind of get inside, like implicitly requires you to get inside the person's head in a way which is really unhelpful. It's sort of asking you to make the distinction whether they know or they don't know that what they're saying isn't true. And you know, I think in most situations it's actually very hard to kind of make that determination about like what is the person actually thinking. But yeah, it's that line of kind of factual truthfulness is probably my general rule of thumb. Obviously there's a lot of context in which someone might say something that isn't provably untrue, in the sense that you can't point to like a research paper or sort of some other really hard piece of evidence to say that it's untrue, but you believe very deeply that it's untrue. And those ones are kind of quite tricky, and I'm sort of much more careful about sort of using words like misinformation or disinformation about some of that. I think propaganda is quite a useful term. Some people use malinformation, but I'm not a big fan of that term personally, because I think it brings in this sense of like a value judgment, because mal obviously meaning bad, so it's bad information, this idea of like a value judgment. I think it's a really tricky and like it's a really tricky question, and it's so context based. Yeah, it's I mean, this is one of the fundamental questions of human society, right? Like, what should you be allowed and not allowed to say is something that we've been debating since the dawn of time, and we will continue debating until the end of time.
At least you mentioned before that some of the state-based efforts have not been very good. Is there anyone that is sort of running any sort of project that seems effective?
So one of the things that I will be writing about quite soon, and that I think has actually been like a fascinating shift specifically from Russian actors over the past like 18 months or so. Actually, I would date it back to, I think it was early 23 when Evgeny Prigozhin came out and acknowledged that he was the head of the Internet Research Agency or the founder of the Internet Research Agency. Like, I think that is when we started to see this shift of Russian actors who are relishing being exposed. They love it when we put out reports about them. They love it when the US Department of, so the US Department of Justice, for example, came out and accused Reba and Mikhail Svinchuk, which is a sort of a Russian state associated media organization, of interfering in the US elections. They offered, I think, a $10 million reward for information about Svinchuk. And I cannot tell you how absolutely gleeful he was about that. And I think that's sort of representative of like a broader shift that we are seeing across particularly Russian covert information operators enjoying being exposed and sort of like finding ways to use media coverage to their advantage in a similar way that we have seen extremist actors on the far right, extremist Islamist actors learning to exploit Western media coverage to their own advantage. And so I think from what I've seen, there haven't been a large number of like super successful covert Russian influence operations. Obviously, we don't know what we don't know. Like, by definition, if they're covert, do we know about them? Like, are the really good ones exposed? Don't know. But from what we've seen, we haven't seen any like particularly effective covert efforts that we saw during the election, the US election campaign. It was kind of mostly, there's a lot of stuff that was kind of like limited to sort of putting out various like badly edited AI videos and that kind of a thing that would get sort of a small amount of traction and then quite quickly be exposed. But some of them, I think, potentially designed to be exposed, and like they actually kind of want to get that media attention. And on that level, I think they've actually been very successful in finding ways to exploit the media attention to create this sense that Russia is interfering everywhere all the time and they're super effective at it, which is not true. So in that sense, I think they are actually doing quite well. Does that make sense?
It does. You've got to hand it to them. Wait, no, you don't have to hand it to them.
Yeah, but there's that drill tweet. But yeah, so one of the things actually that I sort of am looking at putting out, I think hopefully in the nearest future, is thinking about ways that we as a sector, the people who kind of look into influence operations, how we can better approach publicizing what we find in a way that is not going to give these guys a helping hand, because they have figured out how to exploit that attention cycle to their own advantage. And often, like, I think we've seen some really interesting stuff in like the leaks that came out earlier this year from the Social Design Agency, which is the organization behind the doppelganger Russian influence campaign that some of your listeners may have heard of, or if you haven't, just go off and Google it. It's massive and has had a ton of media attention. And so earlier this year, there were some leaked documents from inside the Social Design Agency, which is the organization that's behind that. And what those documents showed is that the Social Design Agency was like collecting their own press clippings. So every time doppelganger was being mentioned in the Western media, every time it was mentioned in a government report, mentioned by the US government, the French government, they were collecting all of that and using it as metrics to show to their bosses to prove to their bosses that they were doing great work and deserve more funding. And things like that, I think, are just an example of like why we as a sector, and also the media as well, like the media is the really big amplifier in this space, need to get smarter about how we draw awareness to what is happening without necessarily making them seem like they're 10 feet tall or they're more effective than they are, because they're mostly not very effective. So yeah, I think their effectiveness has been in exploiting our attention more than it has been in changing anybody's mind on a political basis.
Well, Elise, I think that's a good spot to leave it. Thanks so much for coming on. If people want to find you, you are on Blue Sky, elisethomas.bsky.social. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, Andy, that is our show, and that is Yenar Pasaran for the year. We will be back in mid-January. Thanks for everyone who listened in during the year and everyone who donated to the Radiothon. We'll see you in 2025, when I'm sure it'll all be fine.
Yes. See you then. I'm sick and tired.
Kefirs are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white kefir to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to kefirs.org.au. That's kefirs.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your app.